Connect and experience art at the Northfield Arts Guild. Visit our galleries, arts festival, and take in a performance at our theater featuring a full season of dramas, comedies, and musicals. The Guild's gift shop showcases unique art from over 100 local and regional member artists. Come enjoy music from the Cannon Valley Regional Orchestra or the 411 Concert Series. We invite you to explore your creativity in one of our classes. All are welcome at the Northfield Arts Guild. To learn how you can be a part, visit northfieldartsguild.org. Or call 507-645-8877.
Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination, with your host Paula Granquist, is brought to you by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts. And now, Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination.
Good morning. This is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. Thanks so much for listening to the show as we celebrate all things creating and stories. Let's get ready. I hope you are, and ready to tune our imaginations together. Merry summer. Does that sound weird? Happy summer? Better? It had me wondering about the difference between merry and happy. And of course, the internet had a lot to say about this difference. In general, happy, according to the internet, happy is an inner emotional condition. Merry is related to behavior. Merry is a type of happy in a festive way. Happy is related to quiet contentment. And merry is associated with revelry. Are they interchangeable? I'm always fascinated by words and how we understand them and how word use changes over time. Would it be weird to say merry birthday? Maybe this year on your birthday, you desire a merry birthday instead of a happy birthday. I kind of think that sounds like a little bit more fun myself.
I love that.
And that would be okay with me. And so this year, I give you permission to request this turn of phrase from your friends and family. And maybe you will start something joyous and celebratory. And maybe we will change that and we will go make happy and merry on our birthdays. I think that's a good idea. So it's something to consider. Today on Art Zany Radio, we're going to try to figure out how the merry wives from Shakespeare's world are merry. And I also thought about this, so I forgot to ask this question in advance, but do we think that Shakespeare's use of the word merry kind of changed our minds about how we use that word merry, and that maybe that was why part of why it limited what it was, because it became associated with the merry wives? So we'll explore. Today in the Art Zany Radio studio, I welcome to the show stage manager and actor Carney Gray. Welcome to Art Zany Radio.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
Likewise.
And also, Kevin Chapman is an actor from the Northfield Arts Guild production of Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank
it's
you.
It's a pleasure to have both of you. Merry Wives of Windsor opens up, I can't believe this, August 2nd, which is next week,
yep.
Which
yeah,
is
right.
Unbelievable. and there it goes. It happens. You can get lots of details at northfieldartsguild.org, and we'll go over that during the show as well. But Merry Wives of Windsor is a beloved Shakespeare comedy, so we'll go into the details. But I thought we should start just with a few introductions, a little
sure.
bit about yourself, maybe how you are connected to Shakespeare, and perhaps you have some, you know, particular reasons you wanted to do The Merry Wives of Windsor. So we'll start with you. I think this is your first visit to Art Zany Radio.
It is, in fact, my first visit to Art
Welcome.
Zany Radio. Thank you. I appreciate that. Not my first visit to Northfield, nor my first experience with Northfield Arts Guild Theater. I did do Inspecting Carol. I want to say it was December 2014.
Oh, my goodness. You remember
yes,
that. That's a...
Yes.
I can't remember last week.
I think we did the show here, too.
And had a small role in A Streetcar Named Desire in 2015.
Oh, my gosh. It feels like that was just yesterday that I saw that production. Wow.
And then you and I were talking just a little bit earlier about Sonia and Masha and Vanya and Spike, which was... That might have been the last show that Michelle Schwantes directed here.
Yes.
And what a wonderful, fun show. Although it was funny because people would come up to me and they would say, well, what is your function with this show? And I would say, well, I have no official function with this show. You may think of me as the designated reader, because at some point I read every single role in that show in rehearsal.
Woo! Wow.
That was true this time as well.
Yeah, well, true enough.
Well, and we should mention, I think prior we had previewed that Michelle Schwantes would be joining us, but she was unable to make it today. So
she's working on sound design.
Yeah, because that opening date is creeping around the corner.
Yes,
so
yes.
We wanted to give a shout out. I hope she's listening or gets a chance to listen.
Indeed.
We'll miss you and catch you the next time. And Kevin, tell us, you've been on the show before and done a lot of theater in Northfield. Maybe elsewhere. I'd love to hear more of your theater story.
Yeah, well, I did theater when I was younger, but then when I moved to the U.S., the job just didn't allow for it, and so I talked about getting back to it on and off, and it was my friend and fellow thespian, Brian Reed, who, when the Guild decided they were going to do the Scottish play in the park.
The Scottish play, yes.
I had always wanted to try my hand at Shakespeare. I'd always wanted to try my hand at Shakespeare in the park, and when it was, you know, the Scottish play of all things, he just looked at me and said, "You're auditioning." I said, "Okay, I'll do that."
Yeah. Well, we should say that's Scottish accent. I mean, come
yeah,
on.
The Scottish accent. Yeah, what's left of my Scottish accent is actually the real thing. It's just a little. I've been here for 30 years now. So
is that right? Wow.
But yeah, so that started a number of performances here with the Guild, and I've done a few things down at Faribault as well at the Paradise. But I do thoroughly enjoy Shakespeare. I love the language so. I'm just going to say it. Macbeth, Tempest, and now
we're not in the theater, so it's okay to say
it. It's okay. I've got a couple of friends who are super, super superstitious, so I'll occasionally say it in theater just to freak them out. But I'm Scottish, so I figure that cancels it out, right?
There
yes,
you go.
Okay, yes, we're good. You're allowed, yes.
Okay, we're good.
I don't know. That's what I say.
So, yes, I Christmas Story, we did Tempest, Dial M for Murder, down in Paradise. The last big thing that I did was The Play That Goes Wrong, which was an absolute blast. Mm-hmm. And then recently turned my hand to improv, actually. We got on a little Fish improv troupe, it was born out of The Play That Goes Wrong, and we've done a couple of shows now, so look out for those. But
yeah, I got to see them at the which production. See, now I've seen so many plays this summer, I'm like losing my mind trying to remember all the ones that I've done. What a wonderful thing. I think improv is such a great experience.
It helped with that play, and I'm finding it helps with all plays, although improv in Shakespeare's a little trickier.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend trying to improv Shakespeare, but I do think that having improv experience will help your performing.
It does. It absolutely does. So I'm delighted to be back again, and Merrywives is a play I wasn't terribly familiar with, but is a lot of fun.
It is.
Yeah, and that is something that we want to make sure that our listeners are aware of, and of course, Shakespeare's stories are something, as we talked a little bit, that you can be told again and again, or go to the play or act in the play again and again, and they just keep feeling, you know, you can keep connecting to it. It feels like it's something that's meant for us today, even though it was written, oh gosh, we're coming up on, it's over 500 years, isn't it? It must be.
Certainly over 400. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yep. So I forgot to look that up before, but people know it goes a long way back.
Yeah.
So what is it that you think keeps, you know, Shakespeare coming back to the theater and people coming to listen and performers, the most important part?
Well, I think that a lot of it has to do with the relatability of the characters and the situation. And in a lot of cases, the stories of Shakespeare are not even original. Now, this one is. This is a story, because this is one of his more mature works. Mm. And the story goes that Queen Elizabeth was so enamored of the character of Sir John Falstaff from the Henry IV plays that she wanted to see a show featuring Falstaff, but she wanted Falstaff in love.
Isn't that an interesting angle?
And so the story goes, whether it's true or not, was that she wanted this, you know, play written to highlight that character in love, and this is what Shakespeare came up with. And so you can see elements of different plays. For example, towards the end, there's a wonderful kind of a fairy fantasy sequence that very much borrows from A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Absolutely, yeah, it really does.
That is fascinating. What were you going to say about this idea of Shakespeare again and again?
Well, I think one of the things when we talked about a little bit earlier outside was that, and I again, being Scottish, I like to relate to a little bit to Robert Burns as well. And Robert Burns is very well known as having written poetry more for fun. He wasn't really doing it for profit. He was writing it for, I don't want to say for the people, but for the common person, that it was very accessible. There's stories about him writing poetry in the condensation on bar windows because it occurred to him there when he was having drinks with his friends. And I think Shakespeare, for all the fact that it has certainly been elevated in a lot of ways, was really kind of writing to the same thing. It was you know, bums on seats. It was kind of like people into the
very
theater.
Much popular entertainment.
Exactly,
yes.
And I think it's a great phrase for it. So I think the fact that it was written at that level makes it accessible and applicable and also malleable. I mean, one of the great things about Shakespeare is that you can perform it, the same play over and over again in 100 different ways. And it works. Yeah. You can transplant it from one time period, from one situation to another. You can play with the characters. One of the things that's great about looking through the language is any one speech, even just a few lines, you can look at it and go, I can deliver this 100 different ways.
Yeah.
And I think the language lends itself to that, partly because we're not as familiar with it. I mean, you could do that for probably most writing, but his language in particular, it's just infinitely malleable.
Yes, and talking about the language, I do think that is the principal thing that Shakespeare offers us, and particularly why actors are attracted to it. Because, like I mentioned before, a lot of the stories were not original. But what is uniquely Shakespearean is the language itself, the word choice, the sentence structure. So if you take away the language, then you don't have Shakespeare anymore. If you just say, well, I don't know if I want to kill myself or not, that's not as poetic or as beautiful or as intriguing as to be or not to be.
Right? That is true, right? It has that element of just, you know, like awe, right? You just, oh, that is a turn of phrase that grabs you, that makes you sit down and you sort of like have to work around it and ponder it and think, wow, that goes a lot of different ways. Like you said, it's malleable.
Yep. And there's a great video that you can find online of a lot of the actors who have performed the lead in Hamlet in the UK coming on stage and saying, to be or not to be, that is the question. And then the next actual comment is, no, it's to be or not to be. And they literally go through like a dozen actors emphasizing one different word, and you're listening to them going, damn, that does change the entire meaning of the thing. Well, that's incredible.
Yeah, and how many words is that? Six or so, something?
Right. Yeah. It's quite fun.
Yeah, that's what makes it great. And so as an audience member, I can appreciate that because I see something different every time that, you know, and because of the choices that the director has made or the cast and crew have made, then it becomes anew to me. And I can, maybe there's an emphasis on something. You're like, I didn't really, you know, that hadn't been drawn out, or I'm different now. And I see something different, or I'm at a, you know, now I'm married and I have kids, and I see this in another way. So that's kind of the magic of it. So it's very exciting that the Arts Guild is doing this. And we should mention too that this is Shakespeare in the theater.
Correct. It is not in the park this year. It is in the theater. And the director, Michelle Schwantes, wanted it to be indoors just because the theatrical experience for her includes the elements of theatrical lighting, sound design, costuming, and also kind of a distraction-free environment.
Nicely put, yes.
For everybody, right? Because that outdoor can't, has those elements that are impossible to predict and difficult to prepare and makes another element of the play that could go wrong.
Right, indeed. I did a couple of seasons of outdoor Shakespeare in Louisville, Kentucky with Kentucky Shakespeare Festival.
But it was toasty warm.
Yeah, well, Louisville is a hub for what's the delivery service?
FedEx.
Not FedEx, other one.
That's Memphis. It must be UPS then.
UPS, oh, thank you. Sure. So it's a hub for
we
UPS.
We equally promoted all of them.
Yeah, I know, right? And so on any given night during the performance, one of these jets would go over. And so the convention was that when the jet was going over, when it was, you know, right above the stage, the actors would simply pause wherever they were and wait until the sound began to subside and then resume the play.
So about trains.
Oh, that we have. we've even though it's so far away at Central Park from the trains, it does carry.
Yeah, and the theater is not far away from the track.
Nope, not at all.
That's I attended a meditation thing in a building nearby there one time, and the person leading the meditation was talking about, you know, being in the middle of this peaceful forest, and then you heard the train coming, and I have to give this woman full credit. She incorporated, and in the distance you heard a train rumble itself down the tracks. Just like, well played.
Well, meanwhile, the building is...
you feel it, that's for sure. It's very immersive. Piggyback a little bit of what you were saying about the theatre, I mean, the Guild Theatre, of course, is a fun little space. It's a very, very small space, but that lends itself even more to the immersive nature that you're talking about there, Carney. It's like, I mean, you can shake hands with the audience halfway through the audience, you know, when you're standing up on stage almost there. And so if you've got a vision like Michelle's, which is that immersive, once you're in there, you're fully immersed. It's such an intimate space. Right. You can't help but being a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. And so let's talk about how I'm sure that Michelle started thinking about this many months ago.
Yes.
And so I was thinking about how the cast and crew began to explore the Merry Wives of Windsor, and where you began, or how you all discovered the, you know, what was going to be a part of this production. Do you want to start, Kevin?
Sure. Obviously, auditioning some ideas for certain parts, and I was fairly certain of which part I was likely to be out of anyway, because Michelle's last question to me, how do you feel about accents? and I play Sir Hugh Evans, who is a Welshman, so I got to work on that quite a bit. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about the Welsh accent and where that kind of played into the part. And once I offered the part, it was like, okay, you've got to figure out who Sir Hugh is, and he's one of the more comic elements. He's one of the elements in the play that is made fun of a lot. And so sitting down and figuring out, okay, so where in the play does that really come to the front?
And you have to be funny in Welsh and have people still understand it.
Well, this is the, you know, so Shakespeare, we talked about Shakespearean language and the iambic pentameter, which is the rhythm and meter that I always found helped me learn lines. This is written
almost exclusively in prose, very little verse in this show.
And that's, which has made it somewhat trickier, at least for me. I find that harder without the rhythm to play on. But for Sir Hugh, so what we're talking about is what, mid-16th century English written phonetically to try and emulate a bad Welsh accent.
Right.
Ooh, that's so a challenge.
So a lot of it was... So the first thing I do for any Shakespeare play is I will find one of the many resources online that actually has the original and the translated, the English modern translation online, just so I understand the flow. Because there's always parts where it's like, oh, that's not what I thought that meant.
Sure, right, because you need to know the story, kind of, where are we beginning, where's our...
Exactly, and what did he mean in this... What was he going for in this particular phrase, in this particular context? And then, for me at least, in this particular one, it's like, what is he making fun of in Welsh? Why is he writing this way? So I actually had to switch to... I've been listening to a lot of... there's a Welsh entertainer and actor, Rob Brydon, who did a series of interviews during the pandemic with other actors, all kinds of actors. We had obviously a number of Welsh ones, including Reese fans, Matthew Rhys, Michael Sheen, and I've been listening to a lot of them. I've been listening to them over and over again in his podcasts as I drive into work and as I drive home again, to try to get the accent right so that I could lampoon it appropriately and not without actually really destroying the accent to any Welsh them that might be listening. But once I did that, I was able to see what Shakespeare was doing with, you know, when he writes, oh my God, it's oh my God. And if you listen to the Welsh accent, the D is softer, it's oh my God. It's kind of halfway between the two. And
he uses look you a lot.
He does look you, he does use look you a lot. And it turns out that's kind of a sore point with the Welsh, because it was Shakespeare that introduced that, 400 years ago? And people are still mimicking it, using that. We don't say that. We never say that in Wales. We don't say look you. That's not a thing we do.
And there you are saying it.
And there I'm like a dozen times throughout the play, and it's entirely Shakespeare's fault. So a lot of it, for me at least, is looking, whether it's Welsh or not, looking at the language and trying to get comfortable with the language, but also making sure that I understand the flow of the whole story. because it's easy to just focus on your own lines, but because of the language, you're not necessarily going to be able to follow everyone else's stuff, including the people you're on stage with, unless you really understand what they're saying as well. So you can't just listen for it. You have to make sure you're interpreting the Shakespeare correctly. So it's a bit of work. There's a little bit of homework going into something like this, I think. But it's fun.
Yes. Yeah, probably even before you got together as a cast then have yourself at a point where you could, you know, engage and do some table reads and things.
Yep. Yeah. And anytime you're using a dialect, you have to be very careful about articulation. You have to even over-articulate because the audience not only has to get their minds around these words and these sentences, but also, you've got that dialect. And so if you're not super clear in your language, the audience can lose what you're saying.
Yeah, and that would be the worst thing to happen because you want them to follow the story and get the jokes.
Yes. however, speaking of jokes and speaking of Sir Hugh, one of the things that I did want to bring up is what the audience is going to find when they see Kevin's Sir Hugh is a character that has a tremendous amount of humanity. And he's very touching. And Sir Hugh has got some very kind of introspective moments where the audience is going to sigh. And I'm going to be disappointed if somebody doesn't cry just a little bit.
No pressure.
Before the end of the play.
All right, then. I guess I got some work to do in the next week.
Not at all. Not at all. Because as stage manager, I sit there and, you know, I watch the play each night and I watch Kevin's performance. And it's really nice to see someone using subtlety and nuance and pathos. And so it's really a delightful character. And I think the audience is really going to enjoy Sir Hugh. And he'll be a nice counterpoint to some of the louder, broader characters.
Well, perhaps that's a good transition.
Such as Master Ford, who is the quintessential jealous husband.
Oh, yes.
And it's a good thing that this is a comedy, because I think that Master Ford could be quite threatening in another story. But because it's a comic approach, you know, and he's made fun of, it remains firmly in the comic realm. And one of the challenges that I had with Master Ford is how to make him genuinely threatening but not disturbing to the audience. So it is a kind of a fine line. And then, like some of the other characters, I had to use more than one dialect, because in addition to Master Ford, he also appears to Sir John Falstaff as Master Brooke, where he has a disguise. And so, you know, he's got this wig and he's got glasses and he's got a clearly false beard. and then he has this dialect, which is different than Master Ford's dialect. Now, Master Ford is middle class. This is the only show that Shakespeare ever wrote that highlights the middle class rather than nobility and so forth. And so Master Ford has aspirations. He's upwardly mobile. And so when he's in company, he tries to speak more towards what they would call a London accent, which is not exactly upper crust, but it's definitely not Cockney or East End.
Right.
But then when he appears to Falstaff and he's Master Brooke, you know, in his disguise, one of the things that I tried to model that dialect on was the character of the Duke in Moulin Rouge.
Mm.
Yes.
Nice. I hadn't caught that. You're right.
And at the end, should somebody die?
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's
You're absolutely right. I hadn't picked up on that.
That is brilliant. What it is. So,
and sometimes that does help actors if they can find a character to model the vocal on.
Oh, very much
and,
so.
And it's something I've suggested to some of our younger actors in the show. And we do have some young ones, which I kind of actually only recently discovered. We have one actor who is as young as 15, but they are very tall, and it never occurred to me that they were not of the age of majority. And I was just like, oh, goodness gracious. So we've got a range from about 15 up to probably 70.
Mm-hmm. That's the delight of community theater and Shakespeare as well. There are characters of all ages. Mm-hmm. And we should tell people a little bit about The Merry Wives of Windsor and sort of the storyline, because we've talked a little bit about your characters, but we haven't talked about the Merry Wives, who are essential in this play. So who wants to give us a little rundown on...
I'll let Carney take the point. The one thing I will say is that the Merry Wives, I mean, this, and I think you'll talk to this better than I could, but the wives themselves, Mistress Page and Mistress Ford, are really the smart cookies in this play. I mean, they're the ones behind the scenes, kind of running circles around everybody. And that's one of my favorite things about this play is that the Merry Wives is not just the title. No, they're in command and control, and it's their show in so many ways, which is wonderful.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think one of the lines that Mistress Page has is, "Wives can be faithful and merry too." And because the whole impetus of the thing is that Ford suspects his wife of infidelity with Sir John Falstaff. And I think it all stems from that early scene where Falstaff kisses her hand.
Yes.
And then there's an opportunity there, you know, for this comic, you know, plot to proceed. And because Ford is as jealous in his way as Othello is in his, but just in a more, you know, comic way. Mm. And so the wives, first of all, they want to set the jealous husband straight, but they also want to be revenged on Falstaff, who thought that the two of them could be so easily manipulated.
Right, that's the part we haven't talked about yet. Yeah. He's the one who sort of comes to town and thinks he's, you know.
Yeah, he meets Mistress Ford that first time and immediately says, "Oh, I bet there's money." He gets the correct notion that for these two households, the ladies control the money and are probably have some authority within the household. And so he says, "Well, you know, I'm Sir John Falstaff. I am this heartthrob, this 2 yard round heartthrob, and he's going to woo them and woo them out of their money, etc., etc." So it's a great scheme on his part, and like I said, they just own him. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful, and so they get revenge upon the jealous husband. And with this being Shakespeare, it's like, okay, so we've got a couple of false and played out and acted out romances, but let's have a couple of other things going on as well. So we have, and then we have the whole Mistress Anne Page, who has three suitors that are, Sir Hugh is kind of in the court of one, but friends with another, and so doesn't really care who ends up marrying Mistress Anne Page. And then that's all kind of revolving off to the side while the Sir John Falstaff and wives plot is going on and carrying straight through, but so John Falstaff's not really he's not the good guy. He's very much the cad.
Yes, very
play.
Much so.
Yeah. I guess his comeuppance.
Exactly, yeah. And that's what makes this play so fun and so timeless, perhaps.
Right,
being able that's enjoyable to watch. And we should mention this is Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. I'm here with Carney Gray and Kevin Chapman from The Merry Wives of Windsor, which is opening up next week at the Northfield Arts Guild Theater, and it runs for 2 weekends, Fridays and Saturdays. The show is at 7:30 and Sundays at 2 p.m. So tickets are available online. You might want to get them ahead of time so that they don't sell out.
It's because, a small theater.
Yeah, and it would be a disappointment if you got there and had planned an evening. So that it's very easy to do. You can also come downtown to the location on Division Street and go ahead and purchase your tickets in advance. But online, very easy. Tickets are $20 for adults, $16 for seniors and students. And again, it is August 2nd through the 11th, 2024, I should say, if this ever gets repeated, so you know when that's happening. And it's just a really delightful play. I wanted to ask about the setting, the Windsor. Now, when we hear Windsor, sometimes we think of the House of Windsor.
Yes, of course.
But this is written for sort of the everyday folks. So is this the same Windsor?
It is the same Windsor, yes. And in fact, one of the scenic elements is the silhouette of Windsor Castle that kind of looms over the action of the play.
Oh, okay.
And at that time, Windsor was very much an affluent suburb of London. And so the reason that the Fords and the Pages live in Windsor is because they're upwardly mobile and they were able to, you know, purchase nicer homes in a quiet kind of rustic, you know, bucolic setting. But it's still a town that has a great deal of business going on. And that's kind of the setting, is the Windsor that was at that time.
Mm-hmm. And we should also mention, because one of the things about the production of a Shakespeare play is that there are lots of choices that you can make about right. where and the, you know, the setting and maybe the pacing of it, or maybe the era or the language. You know, so I'd love to hear a little bit about the choices that this production is undertaking to bring it to life. What are some of the things that people can expect to see on stage?
Right. Well, one of the choices that the director, Michelle Schwan, has made was to, rather than set this in the Elizabethan period, she put it in the late Victorian period.
Mm.
And it wasn't a random choice, because nothing she does is ever random.
That's good for us to know, right? Like, yeah. Pay attention.
Yes.
There's something that this is trying to tell you as you have this experience. And what would that mean? What does that look like for the characters?
So for the late Victorian period, there are kind of different social and societal kind of resonations, and I think that's mostly what she was going for, was to take this story and the dynamics of this story and the relationships and the characters and set it in the late Victorian period because of the kind of things that were going on at that time.
Mm.
And so for the audience, it might not be immediately apparent what the differences are, but the more you know about, you know, English history, about the Victorian period, you'll be able to recognize why she thought that this was a period that would facilitate this particular story.
And what were the costumes, maybe we'll see, notice?
I was about to say, actually, the costumes as well are, still talking over a century ago, but it probably a little bit more identifiable in terms of being able to say, oh yeah, that's the outfit of somebody at this level of society, for example. You know, the pastor's always going to be a little bit more formal, but the wives, for example, they're outfits that are going to, that because of, you know, period dramas, things like that, in television and other media, you don't tend to focus a great deal on the 15 and 1600s. but late 1800s, early 1900s are things that people say, oh, I either going to look at the costuming and get an immediate sense for where in society these particular characters sit. And so I think that it's hard to say identifiable again a century later, but more identifiable, more accessible. I was like, oh, I think I see what's going on here. I see who these people are versus related to those people, that kind of thing.
And it was, of course, the period that Oscar Wilde's plays were set in. And so people would probably be familiar with that period because of, you know, The Importance of Being Earnest or any of his other more popular plays. Those were all Victorian.
Sure, and Ibsen would have been probably in that era as well.
Yep, absolutely.
So which brings me to that question of female power in this play.
Yes.
And it makes me think, so I can only know how it feels as, you know, a person living in this era,
right.
But I would imagine over time that you know, is played differently.
Yes.
You know, the fact that those women do give him his comeuppance.
Right.
That's an interesting thing. Is that a conversation you've had as a cast and crew?
Yes, because one of the things that people often will observe about Shakespeare is that a lot of the Shakespearean characters are very much about duty and obedience, and in fact, particularly the younger women in Shakespeare are often treated by their fathers as property.
Mm.
Yes.
And so what you have here, in contrast, are mature women that are very self-possessed and have a sense of who they are and their own power. And, I mean, they're still within a system where, you know, men are kind of running things, but these are two women who know what's going on, and as we mentioned earlier, are pretty much able to run circles around their husbands. And that's part of what drives the comedy.
I think also that even a couple of the younger women, and you know, avoid spoilers and for those that may not have ever seen the play before, we want to come and say, but even you know, Mistress Anne Page, to some extent, she is a lot more in charge of what she wants than is necessarily apparent immediately in the play, and certainly to her parents. So it does actually, it's not just the more mature woman, it's actually, you see a little bit of this in some of the younger female parts as well, which is, again, it's kind of great to see that the women really do stand out in this play in that regard. And again, no clue what that would have been like in the 1500s, 1600s, let alone the late 1890s.
Yeah, right. That's what I was thinking. Is, you know, it's hard for us to be able to put ourselves in that place. And I suppose, you know, I always think of, it wasn't that long ago when, you know, my grandmother didn't have anything in her own name, right?
Right.
She didn't have a credit card. Right. She didn't have a checking account. She didn't have, I don't know, I don't think she had her name on the, you know, house deed or any of those things. And that was just, you know, a few decades ago. Right.
Certainly. And some members of that older generation, if you ask them, you know, who are you? Well, I'm Mrs. Robert Thompson.
Yes.
And so they very much identified with their husband and with his, you know, profession and position. And that was where they derived their status from. And as you say, you know, credit cards, bank accounts, these were not available.
Yeah, and so you think about that and think about, well, you know, back in the 1500s or 1890s or whatever it might have been. It's really interesting to me to sort of play with that idea of how everybody was perceived in their roles and what the audiences might have seen and what Shakespeare was doing. I mean, like, that feels radical.
Here's a completely wild speculation, but since this, you know, we talked about the fact that this play was largely written at the Queen's request because she wanted to play a feature Falstaff, well, maybe Shakespeare decided, well, at the Queen's request, I should maybe elevate the women in the play a little bit more. There you go. I just made that up completely, but we'll see if we can
Into Canada. I like it. Okay.
That could possibly be true. Right. And we will debate about that for centuries.
Right. Fantastic. I'm done here.
My work here is done.
And that's what we can do with Shakespeare. Mm. And, of course, one of the other decisions is language, and we touched on it briefly as, you know, how to present the play in the dialect, or do it, I've heard it's, you know, just straight, you know, American English. You can
right.
And so that's really fascinating to me too, because every time you make a change, you change the play a little bit.
Absolutely.
And so so how have you as a cast and crew wrangled with some of those decisions? Because, like, even what you said with the example of to be or not to be, the way you place which word has the prominence changes everything.
Right.
So that gets, you know, if you start going down that rabbit hole of how I say each line and even each syllable.
Yeah, absolutely. And because Michelle wanted to make sure that we were using the correct English dialects for this show, it's something that we started working on from day one with the cast.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often for Shakespeare, at the very least, you have to use what they refer to as stage standard, which recently people have been calling mid-Atlantic.
Oh,
but I always knew it as stage standard.
What is that?
But
I haven't heard that
phrase.
It's
the same way that if you're familiar with the show Frasier, David Hyde Pierce and what's his name?
Kelsey Grammer?
Yeah, Kelsey Grammer. They both speak in stage standard for that show. And so it's kind of a little more elevated American English that has something in common with the British English. And so that was kind of a starting point. But then you need to take it just a little bit further than that. And if you're portraying a lower character, you're going to go towards the Cockney or the East Ender accent. If you're portraying kind of a higher character, then you're going to go more towards the received pronunciation, the higher class English accent.
The BBC and so, English.
What's that?
The BBC English.
Yeah, the BBC English, exactly. And so You'll find all of those in this play, but as I mentioned before, the critical thing is that you make sure that you're very clear with your diction, because if you're using an accent, the audience has to be able to still hear and understand the words you're using, and some of these phrases are fairly complex.
And it's and when you're approaching language, and you're talking about, you know, where to place the emphasis, I mean, so much of it is I mean, it's multifactored. There's partly what the director wants. So how you're going to deliver this particular line is going to be impacted a lot by what the director's looking to get from that scene. There's what you've actually, how you've imagined the character. The notion of Sir Yu, for example, he likes to play this mediator. He wants to be involved with this. Anytime there's the invocation of God, he gets very serious, and his voice, his register will drop, and it's the only moments when he's actually kind of, he sounds commanding in the thing, and that's a deliberate choice there because I thought it'd be fun to play with the contrast, and that seems to have worked. But you've also got a play of what, and again, this is true for any play, but it's a little tricky with Shakespeare. We play what the other actors are wanting to do with theirs, and so again. Any play, any English, any script you're handed, you can play with that to some extent. But because you're actually having to learn the words, and because a lot of the way Shakespeare writes his words may have multiple meanings, and certainly are out of context with a lot of the meanings, I should say, in modern English, you really have to be conscious of the direction that everybody's taking at once and be thinking about a lot more. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about having to really know the other part going into it, so you have an idea what your starting point is, so you don't get halfway through the play and decide, no, we've got to massively completely change direction on this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's phrases, and it starts to come out in the performance as well, because as you struggle with the language to begin with, but as you get more comfortable with it and you get comfortable with what you're trying to get across, you'll start to see moments of, oh, that's what's happening there. I think there was a scene, Young Master Slander, where he's accusing various thugs of certain things, and I'd read the script, and it's just saying, like, hey, I'm accusing you, and I'm accusing you, and I'm accusing you. And when I realized what's actually happening, he's, I'm accusing you, then that person kind of is very threatening. Oh, no, I didn't mean you, I meant you. Oh, no, I didn't mean you, I meant you. Entirely different. It's like, oh, I have to react completely differently to this particular situation because I totally misread it. That's not what I got from it at all. And so developing it, developing the understanding of the meaning and tweaking the meaning and then changing where you're going to put the emphasis, as the show is evolving, and it just continues to evolve throughout rehearsals, and probably will through the performance as well, let's be honest.
Thank you for that example, because I think that really does help people. You know, you can read something and you can think you know it, but then if you have to perform it and then you're bouncing off of something, you know, it takes on new nuance, and and you have to keep playing with that as you perfect this performance. And so that's so fascinating. I think it truly is. Were you going to add something?
Well, yes. For example, when Master Ford comes in to see Sir John Falstaff at the Garter Inn, the tavern, and he's in the character of Master Brooke, you know, he comes in and he's using very obsequious language. I make bold to press with so little preparation upon you. And so it's very kind of more formalized language than we would typically use today. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but for him it's, I make bold to press with so little preparation upon you. Mm. And that's just one example of the more formal structure of the language and how it informs the character, who he is and what he's trying to do.
Right. It sounds like a play that you could get tickets to multiple nights and you could
indeed
keep learning things from
indeed
it.
So yeah.
They could see it multiple times and you'll have many opportunities. The play is Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30, August 2nd through the 11th, and then Sundays at 2. So there's multiple times to see it, but it's it is still limited, and it'll only be done this way once in this place, in this
that is true
space.
True.
And
very true.
That's what makes live theater so incredible.
Yeah.
What are some of the great stories that have happened for the cast and crew as they've been, you know, putting this together, or, you know, discovering things, or,
well,
you know, understanding Shakespeare? You both are laughing and smiling, so I can't wait.
One of the fun and interesting challenges are some of the unique type of set pieces that we've had some wonderful people help to create. Mm-hmm. For example, in the fifth act, when we shift to Windsor Park, mm-hmm. there is a tree mentioned called Hearn's Oak, Hearn the Hunter. And so we're like, well, what are we going to do for this tree? We've got to have a tree. I mean, it's kind of the focal point, and everybody mentions it. And so we have this young fellow from the area here, Isaac, and he's like, I can make a tree. And so last night, for the first time, we brought this tree on stage, and we're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh. That's Hearn's Oak.
Yeah. It was amazing. It's like, oh, and there we go. We have our scene. We have our set.
What is it made of? Or is it going to, are you leaving it for?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'm.
Surprise.
I don't feel like I can divulge Isaac's secrets.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
Something to behold.
But I would say that it's pretty convincing.
Okay.
Pretty convincing. There's another, I don't know, this is almost like a wearable prop or wearable set piece because it is the buck basket that Sir John Falstaff crawls into in
buck
order,
basket.
Yes, like a laundry basket because they're going to take it to, you know, bucking or whiting, for the garments that need to be whited. Bleached. And so when Falstaff is trying to seduce Mistress Ford and learns that Master Ford is on the way with, you know, some other people, he's like, well, I need to hide. Where can I hide? And the wives are like, well, maybe you could go inside this buck basket. And so we had to have something that he could get into.
Yeah, that's gonna be
and
huge.
He's, I mean, Brian Reed is not a small man.
No, he's about my build.
And of course, because he's referred to so often as the Fat Knight, we had to give him some additional girth. And so it's, and I don't want to divulge too much about what happens with the buck basket, but the first time we saw the prototype of the buck basket, we're like, okay, I see how this can work.
That is the magic of theater. I love how you can, you know, have, I just, even watching in between the scenes when things are spinning around or, mm-hmm. you know, being placed or moved, and I just think, wow, I'm certain every detail has been addressed and everything has a, you know, its place in the scene and a reason for it, and every production has to use the space that they have and the props that, you know, that make sense for the era that they're putting it in. And
yes.
I just think it's...
And I love the creativity mm-hmm. of the production staff, because as a small theater, you don't have the resources to just purchase things.
Right.
And so you're faced with this challenge because you need to have this particular, you know, proper set piece, whatever it may be. And so you have to think, well, how can I do this
mm-hmm.
where it'll serve our purposes, it won't be too expensive, but will be convincing for the audience?
Well, and the basic framework of the stage, the set itself, was the same as was used in the last production, I believe, right?
Yes, we repurposed the set from the children's hour because it was already there.
I saw that play, so now I'm trying to figure out what are the elements
a little bit of paint, and a couple of other props, and you know, And this same basic set can be Windsor Park, it can be a parlor, it can be a street. Mm-hmm. One of the things I also like, again, this is, you know, given the size of the theater, is remarkable, but we have one, two, three, four, five entrances and exit points. We're
yes.
using the aisle, using the outside doors, we
yes.
have three different points on stage, and for those that know the theater, this is a tiny space, but
yes.
we have all these different methods
right.
of engaging the stage and engaging the audience coming on and off.
Yes.
We're using literally every entrance, every orifice
Indeed.
In the building. just about to get ourselves through, including a couple of laps of the exterior, I think, for some
yep.
of the actors.
Yep.
So there is a little, you know, in the park element to it,
hey,
then, if
sure.
you're using it outdoors.
For sure. For the actors, at least.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
How wonderful. And so let's maybe I realize how fast the time is going for us. So do we think that women can be both merry and faithful? That was kind of the theme that kept coming up in the you know, reviews of the play and the discussions that people were having, and
I would certainly hope so. I can't think for the life of me any reason why not.
Has your definition of merry changed at all as you've been engaged with this play?
I will confess, I had not thought about it until your introduction. Oh. That's a really interesting point.
And you were talking about, you know, maybe we should wish someone a merry birthday. And I'm like, okay, all right.
Doesn't that make more sense, right? We would like, you know, maybe depending on the person, right? Someone might like a more content, you know, quieter birthday. And someone wants a huge feast and celebration.
And I know that people have had a tendency to kind of use merry and happy interchangeably, but you rightly point out that they're not the same. Mm. And I liked the way you brought out that contrast. Mm. Because we often say Merry Christmas, but in a very popular Christmas poem that gets recited every year, the tagline is Happy Christmas to all and to all a good night. And so he kind of used, you know, the terms interchangeably, or at least we've updated it to add merry instead of happy. But yeah, the difference in the way merry is used now and merry was used then. And, you know, I think in this case, these are merry in the sense of, you know, they are spirited. They have fun with their lives. And so they can still be, you know, dutiful wives, but, you know, they don't need to be kept in these boxes.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's what makes the comedy and the fun and the antics and the disguises and the all the things that happen in a Shakespeare comedy come to life.
Yeah. For real, yeah.
Anything else we should add about Merry Wives of Windsor? The website is northfieldartsguild.org. You can get all those details. Should be right on the front page, or if you need to, click on the theater tab, and you'll be directed to the current season. This is the final play of this current season, which a wonderful delight it's been. How about anything else you want to add to make sure we get those people to buy their tickets now?
The one thing I'll say is it's a large cast. We've talked about some of the characters with the larger number of lines, but I think a lot of the supporting characters in this play are fantastic as well.
Absolutely.
Possibly my favorite character in this play, for example, is Master Slender.
Yes.
Slenders is this young man who's largely clueless. his uncle and the pastor say, you should marry Mr. Santa Page. Okay, I can do that.
Dominic Gill.
And Dominic's doing a fantastic job of it. And you know, as soon as he's told, you should marry her, okay, and is 100% enamored with her from that point on. And it's little things, that a lot of the smaller parts that really flesh out the whole play. And so I often spend as much time, if not more time, watching the supporting cast in the Shakespearean play, because the primary characters are so big and bold, you can't really miss them. But they really, really pay attention to what everyone else is doing, because there's a lot of activity going on, even just expressions and attitude and things like
and
that.
And because we had a smaller turnout for auditions, again, it being summer and all, and we have had to not only reduce the number of roles, but we've had to have some actors portray more than one character. And so we've got some interesting quick change challenges. And Dominic was involved in that, because last night he was practicing his quick changes for the first time. And so we got to know where those challenges are.
Yeah, that is one of the things also that happens in a play that we don't get to see, but just kind of, if you really think about like what just happened and how they, you know, may have to completely,
He goes out one door, changes clothes, comes in the other door as a completely different character.
And you mentioned your false mustache. Beard. It was a beard.
False beard, glasses, wig,
Those things can go wrong.
They can. But in my case, if the beard goes wrong, it's a character choice.
We're going to go with that one. Yep.
And that's that, because the show must go on.
That's right.
Oh, I can't wait. This sounds like a whole lot of fun. The Merry Wives of Windsor at the Northfield Arts Guild. Thank you so much for joining me Art Zany Radio. Kevin Chapman and Carney Gray, welcome. I hope this is a return. You'll return many times to Art Zany Radio and keep bringing us theater. It's just a wonderful delight. So thank you, folks. You should make sure and get your tickets to this Merry Wives of Windsor. We need a little laugh, I think, this summertime. It's a
indeed,
good time.
Indeed. And you'll get laughs out of this one.
Yes, you will.
Yes, and we could use more of that. And I'm going to leave you with this, I guess I'll call it a little dream, because I was packing up to get ready to come to the show, and there was a notebook in my bag, and I was like, oh, I don't need that notebook. It's been there for a long time. It's already been used. It's full. And so I took it out, and I happened to flap open to a page. And I was kind of surprised by what was on that page. It was a quote from the show Rainn Wilson did called The Geography of Bliss, which was such a lovely piece. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to. But the piece that I wrote down was from the Thailand episode. He's trying to discover what is happiness or what is bliss. And Dwayne Rainn Wilson, the one, yes, he played Dwight Schrute on The Office, mentioned these Gallup poll questions. So I'm going to leave you with these, where they are trying to measure the world's emotional temperature. And they ask, think about how you felt yesterday. Did you smile or laugh a lot yesterday? Did you learn or do something interesting? Or were you angry or were you sad? So think about your yesterday, and I would recommend, if you didn't have enough laughter and do something that you was new and interesting, I'm going to flip that around. How are you planning to find joy tomorrow?
Nice.
What will you do to make someone smile? What makes you laugh? And you know, if you laugh, that's infectious. So let's do more of that. Let's create a world with more merriment and even some more happiness.
Here. Beautiful.
Yeah. Dream big. And I hope you'll tell me all about it tomorrow. Folks, this is Art Zaney, Radio for the Imagination. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you always find some time to add Art Zaney to your life and a little merriment. And we'll see you next time on Art Zaney Radio. There's going to be a few rebroadcasts. So I hope you'll enjoy those. I'll be back, and we'll keep learning and tuning our imaginations together. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Art Zaney, Radio for the Imagination, with your host, Paula Granquist. Art Zaney is brought to you each week by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts in Faribault. The Paradise Center for the Arts is a vibrant cultural and artistic gathering spot in historic downtown Faribault. The Paradise is committed to offering high-quality visual and performing art opportunities for Faribault and our region. Regular events spotlight some of the best artists and musicians in our area and throughout Minnesota and the Upper Midwest. Our beautifully restored facility includes art galleries, classrooms, clay and textile labs, a gift shop and rehearsal spaces, in addition to a 300-seat auditorium. Visit ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org for a full schedule of events or call our box office at 507-332-7372. 95.1